Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
I've got the blues. I've got the blues. I've got the alcoholic blues.
Well, in 1919, America did something radical. It made alcohol illegal. Booze was the great enemy, the life destroyer, the devilish brew that unleashed the, quote, looser habits of the unthinking immigrant masses. Well, the 18th Amendment to the Constitution was supposed to cure all that, and when it went into effect in 1920, singers like Bill Murray lamented the loss of their favorite drinks.
No more beer, my heart to cheer. Goodbye, whiskey, you used to make me pretty. So long, highball, so long, Jim. Oh, tell me when you're coming back again.
Well, it was about 15 years before it did come back, but it's easy to look back on Prohibition as an era of scratchy old saloon songs, gangland crime, speakeasies, flappers, and farcical moral absolutism. And perhaps it is all those things. But Harvard historian Lisa McGurr calls America's failed effort to ban alcohol something else entirely. She calls Prohibition absolutely critical in, quote, the building of what we recognize as the modern American state. And McGurr writes about it in the new book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State. She joins us now in the studio. Lisa McGurr, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Meghna, for having me.
It's great to be here. It's really great to have you. I mean, first of all, can I just ask you, what made you want to write about Prohibition in this new way?
What made me want to write about Prohibition initially was just I was exploring other topics about Sacco Vanzetti, lots of interesting things in the 20s, and I realized what we had about Prohibition did not strike me as rich or deep enough. It seemed that there must be more there, and I tried to use the tools of social historians to go beyond these stories of bathtub gin and speakeasies to try to uncover a deeper context by looking at on-the-ground experiences. How did ordinary Americans experience Prohibition in different parts of the country? I love doing history from the bottom up, and this was an effort to get to the experiences of, for example, working class, immigrant, ethnic men and women, different groups, African Americans in the cities and in the countryside, to understand the wide implications of Prohibition for all Americans across the board and the differential implications by race, by class, and by gender.
Which is what makes this so interesting, right? Because, I mean, it really was a social experiment, even though it was done through the instrument of the law, which I guess is how a lot of social experiments are done in the United States. But you also mentioned, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but you mentioned Sacco and Vanzetti, et cetera. And parts of your book do examine what was happening here in the Boston area during the era of Prohibition, because it seems to me that this desire to ban alcohol and its attendant perceived bad qualities does have some pretty strong New England characteristics to it. Like, you write about Protestantism and moral absolutism and an old America versus new immigrants. It's all right here. Can you help us understand how those things come together, say, in someone that you write about a woman named Elizabeth Tilton?
Sure, yes. Elizabeth Tilton, in some ways, is a quintessential example that my book uses. I kind of carry her through the entire story as one of the major actors that helps us understand the broad coalition that brought about the 18th Amendment. Elizabeth Tilton was a quintessential elite Boston reformer. She grew up in Salem, Massachusetts. She came from a long line of very proud of a kind of Unitarian a Protestant family. Her father was a minister. She grew up hearing stories about anti-slavery. She linked the ideals of temperance and prohibition to building what she considered a better, purer America. She was concerned about the problems of industrialization, the problems of proletarianization of this new, broad immigrant culture that was penetrating into Boston and Charlestown and other places.
She's the one where that I took the quote from of the unthinking immigrant masses, though.
Correct. Yes, that's right. So, but this is part of progressive era reform, right? So a lot of reformers that consider themselves part of the progressive reform ethos saw themselves, they had a kind of paternalist mission toward these working class ethnic immigrant masses. And so it's very complicated. There's a very strong nativist strand to their reform efforts. She totally sees herself as working to improve the lives of the laboring classes, but she wants to do it for them in ways that they themselves don't want to have happen.
And at the same time, she's a suffragette, right?
She is a suffragette. And this is there's an interesting gendered component to the coalition that brought about the 18th Amendment. Elizabeth Tilton worked in the early 20th century in the Women's Trade Union League. She worked for the Massachusetts minimum wage law for women. She worked in the Massachusetts Suffrage Association, was its organizational chair. So there's a link between the calls for prohibition and gendered issues. She understood it as a very gendered issue because she saw that the wives of these immigrant working class men, often in these tight spaces, suffered by the sort of excessive consumption of alcohol as she saw it. And she identified that as the reason for the deep poverty that she saw when she visited areas like Charlestown. There were lots of complicated reasons that they were poor, but this is what she saw.
You're right that she says that or she observes in her mind that unlike, say, those fortunate enough to live on Beacon Hill, that the people who were living in Charlestown at the time, because they were living in tenement situations, they literally could not be physically they could not escape the reach, physically escape the reach of excessive drink.
That's correct, right? And so she identifies it as even more of a severe problem for those poor, vulnerable communities. And that is really, the coalition was built in targeting public working class drink in the saloon. It was less about elite consumption, and that's why there were lots of loopholes once the law was put into action.
Okay, so the 18th Amendment is ratified and put into effect in the United States in 1920. I mean, that's obviously a huge change in and of itself. It was ratified in 1919, I should say, mm-hmm. and put into effect in 1920. But at the beginning of chapter 2 of your book, The War on Alcohol, you write a lovely little vignette on sort of how that moment plays out here in Boston. I was wondering if you could read that.
I'd be very happy to. Elizabeth Tilton cheered with anti-liquor celebrants in Massachusetts when the 18th Amendment won ratification in early 1919. Emotions of a very different sort swept the ranks of ethnic working-class communities, the primary target of the new law. On April 19th, just across the Charles River from Tilton's quiet, tree-lined street, a crowd of 50,000 gathered on the Boston Commons to protest the law's impending arrival. Protest organizer M.J. O'Donnell, president of the Central Labor Union, decried the amendment as government by a minority. State Senator John J. Kearney blasted the reform as a trick put over by a faction while the country was distracted by the war. Banners proclaimed, "Establish democracy at home," and "We fought for liberty for all the world, and we want some here at home, too." The Boston Daily Globe declared it one of the greatest mass meetings ever held on the Commons.
That's Lisa McGurr reading from her new book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. Fascinating. I mean, of course, the war referenced here is the First World War, mm-hmm. which is really the game changer to push prohibition into the Constitution. But I want to talk in great detail about what you were saying a little earlier that's sort of baked into that graph, and that is, you know, it's seen as this great project in aid of immigrants, in aid of the lower classes, of the working classes, you know, in part because I imagine industrialists want sober workers in the mm-hmm. factories, but they're also therefore the targets of the criminal effects of prohibition.
Absolutely. And this is one of the great, I think, somewhat unforeseen consequences of what is, after all, a law that's put in effect nationally. The way it morphs into campaigns targeting particular groups and identifying entire groups as criminal. And this is what causes a great amount of resentment for the law by these immigrant ethnic working class communities, as well as African Americans, who are overwhelmingly poor men and women across the country, are the targets of enforcement.
Had the federal government really been in the game of large-scale criminal enforcement before this?
Not large-scale. Of course, the federal government, the Bureau of Investigation was established in 1908, and there had been sort of ways in which the federal government for crimes that could not be contained, the Mann Act, for example, cross-border control of morals, things that where there were cross-border control, federal government was involved. This is the first time there's a massive expansion of the federal government in crime control in 1919 through the 18th Amendment. And it's the first time that crime is really identified as a national problem. And that has all sorts of ramifications for the expansion of the state toward policing and surveillance through prohibition and through the war on alcohol and its collateral effects, of course. Prohibition generated a national obsession over crime and criminality. And out of that, they developed a whole new role at the federal level of the government in crime control. This was a moment where the prison system was expanded, was reorganized. It's a moment where the Federal Bureau of Investigation by the early 30s gains new authority. Policing is professionalized. It's the moment where the uniform crime reports are born. It's the moment, of course, when the Federal Bureau of Narcotics is also born in 1930, directly out of the Prohibition Bureau.
And those things are all still with us. Where the 21st Amendment took care of reversing prohibition itself, but these lasting deep changes in the federal government's stance on sort of substance-based crime are absolutely still with us.
Absolutely still with us. And I think that this is one of the contributions of the book, which I myself did not really understand going into the project, the extent to which alcohol prohibition and narcotics prohibition were symbiotic campaigns. They developed out of the same logic. They shared some of the same sort of bureaucratic spaces of influence within the federal government, and also some of the key personnel that were relevant both to the war on alcohol, what I term the war on alcohol, and the sort of the seedbed of the war on drugs, which began also during this period.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking of Elizabeth Tilton again, because mm-hmm. it seems to me that none of this would have been possible in the early 20th century if it hadn't been for that confluence that you were talking about, the moralism that came through sort of religious fervor, you know, the holier-than-thou sensibility that comes with issues of class, the tensions that come with great waves of immigration. So, you know, and yet it's not as if I feel like the country sort of learned but didn't learn from those experiences, because
right.
those same threads we see in, you know, the endless war on drugs that we have now on narcotics enforcement of a different kind.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's what's interesting. We learned in the sense that, you know, prohibition was widely understood, alcohol prohibition, as a failure, and drink became acceptable. And there was a wide consensus that it was not so dangerous that it needed to be made illegal. But for other narcotics drugs, at the same time, the new campaign was around narcotic drugs in the 1920s, and those repercussions are still with us. Now, it took from the end of the war on alcohol had built the initial infrastructure of the drug war, right? The Federal Bureau on Narcotics, the Marijuana Tax Act, the Harrison Act a little bit earlier. It took another 30 to 40 years for the second war on drugs to basically build what we have now, which is a massive carceral penal state. But that initial infrastructure and many of the logics really come out of this much older ideas, which are linked to alcohol prohibition in the 1920s.
Yeah. Do you have more examples of how, I mean, as you said, you like to view history from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, amongst immigrant communities, amongst working class communities, amongst non-Protestant communities, really on a day-to-day basis, how were the effects of this vastly expanded federal system felt in the wake of prohibition?
Well, I'm going to give you one extreme example, which is that prohibition, in fact, not only did it contribute to selective enforcement and contribute to dramatically rising prison numbers in states like Virginia, North Carolina, and Texas, which in itself is an experience, right? There's policing and state policing, local police and federal agents are breaking down doors, and men and women are not only being fined but going to prison. Less so in places like Massachusetts, where they're being slapped on the hand in court bargain days, but in many parts of the country, they're going to prison. But there's one more way in which men and women felt the targets, and that is that prohibition, in fact, in ways that are not widely known, really did help spark the incredible dynamic growth of what I call a citizens' enforcement army. That, in other words, the federal government, state officials, and local police could not rein in violations. And citizens who wanted to back the law decided for themselves that they would become enforcers. The WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the Anti-Saloon League both worked very hard for enforcement of the prohibition law. But also the Ku Klux Klan utilized the law instrumentally to target groups that they anyhow saw as the enemies of white Protestant nationalism. So it really is the 18th Amendment and Volstead Act that helps to explain why it was that the Klan grew so dynamically at the moment it did.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting because as I was reading the book, your book, The War on Alcohol, oftentimes I just thought, if we changed dates, if we changed names, if we changed the word alcohol to, you know, name your other substance, this book could have been set today, quite frankly, because we are in this moment of thinking about sentencing reform. We're thinking about, you know, the decades-old war on drugs, et cetera. And that led me actually back to something that you wrote in the preface of the book, because you quote historian Richard Hofstadter, a very influential historian, and he wrote about prohibition that it was, quote, a symbol of the moral overstrain of the preceding era, the butt of jokes, a perennial source of irritation, a memento of the strange power of crusades, of absolute morality to intensify the evils they hope to destroy. I mean, in other words, you write that for a long time, people look back on prohibition as this joke, this failed experiment, you know, something to be sort of left in the dustbin of American history. And I wonder if that's a big mistake that we as a country have made, because then we didn't learn the lessons that prohibition has had to offer, because in a sense, we are repeating the very same things with the, you know, the 30-year-long, quote unquote, war on drugs now.
Absolutely. I think that is absolutely the case, that there are so many, not only were these campaigns symbiotic, there's so many parallels that neglecting and not understanding the history of prohibition accurately, the ways in which it contributed to penal state building, we have failed to see the way that we are continuing essentially along those same paths and the flaws that are inherent in any crusade against these recreational substances. I mean, addiction is a huge problem, as your prior show just discussed. However, the solution is not these kind of prohibitionary measures that was proved in the 1920s. By 1933, there's a wide consensus. Hopefully now we're getting to a place where there's a little bit of opening to break the consensus that has developed on the war on drugs, because the implications have been, I think, even far more devastating on a domestic and a global scale.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not to say that I'm advocating for the legalization of any narcotic right now, but I am curious, because it occurs to me that there's roughly a 15-year period where prohibition is in full force in the United States, a prohibition of alcohol, I should say, whereas, you know, we're in this decades-long war on other forms of narcotics. I mean, is there something different about alcohol versus the drugs that we have now that gives the war on drugs a certain staying power that prohibition did not have?
Absolutely. I think that's the key, those differences. Despite all of the parallels, it's the differences that explain how and why the war on drugs has proved so much further long-lasting than alcohol prohibition. So, of course, alcohol prohibition was far more widespread in its use, and other narcotic drugs were deemed even more dangerous. They were identified even more with marginal poor populations. And so a consensus could be established around their eradication that could not for alcohol prohibition. And the campaigns, in some ways, that's one of the lessons that a lot of the folks that were involved in alcohol prohibition learned. They began to turn their energies toward these other narcotic drugs at the moment where alcohol prohibition was deemed a failure and it was clear that it would be rescinded. They already had bureaucratic spaces of influence in the federal government. They didn't want to lose those. And they turned increasingly toward the war on narcotic drugs. But it's precisely the difference. It's precisely the difference between the war on drugs and the war on alcohol that has enabled one to proceed unimpeded for so many years.
Well, my last question for you is this seems to be a very particularly American story, like an American solution to a problem that could affect any country. There's a certain moralism to it that we haven't fully outgrown.
It is, in a sense, lots of countries grapple with, in large European industrialized countries, northern countries, Scandinavian countries grappled with heavy drink. It's a problem that many countries have confronted. The solution of the absolutist solution of absolute prohibition rather than partial measures or regulation is something I think that is quintessentially American.
I mean, it's an exceptionalism of a different kind, right?
Yes. And that logic is a logic that still infuses the war on drugs. We criminalize drug use rather than large traffickers. We throw sort of minor violators in prison for long sentences in the same way that happened in the war on alcohol, and therefore escalate the numbers of folks in prison and incarcerated. And that is, I think, that penal and punitive prohibitionist approach came out of alcohol prohibition is still with us and is somewhat unique to, at least in terms of sort of Western industrialized nations, to the United States.
And as you write in the book, it sort of gives, it informs how Americans see, you know, the use of federal power as well, which is, of course, also still with us today. Well, the new book is The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. It's by Harvard historian Lisa McGurr. What a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Meghna. It's been a pleasure.
We've got more of the show coming up in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.